Welcome to Off Script with Dan Dwyer on Robinhood Radio, featuring in-depth interviews with guests from the world of theater and allied arts. Underwriting support from Johnny Cake Books in Salisbury, Connecticut, whose collection of rare collectible and out-of-print books is housed in a 19th century cottage in one of the most old-fashioned small towns in New England. And now, here's the host of Off Script, Dan Dwyer.
Well, thank you, Marshall, and thank you everyone who's tuning in to Off Script. If you think the world needs another movie star biography, let alone another about perhaps the silver screen's biggest sex symbol of all time, think again. There's a new, exhaustively researched biography of Marilyn Monroe that breaks new ground called Marilyn Monroe, The Private Life of a Public Icon. And my guest today is its author, Charles Cacillo. Charles is an authority on Marilyn Monroe, having authored a previous work about her called The Marilyn Diaries. He's also the author of The Fame Game, Boys, and Lost and Found. His work has appeared in the New York Times, the LA Times, New York Magazine, and a bunch of other national publications. And he's also a screenwriter, so this author knows well about what he writes. Welcome, Charles.
Hi, it's good to be with you.
Well, thanks for coming on Off Script. Now, you've written a previous book about Marilyn, which I refer to, called The Marilyn Diaries. Why another book about Marilyn, or to put it another way, what's different about this one that you wrote about in the first one?
Well, the first one I did was actually a novel. It was a fictitious recreation of Marilyn.
Okay.
At the time, the reason that I did it that way is because I didn't feel there was enough new information about Marilyn at that time. I wrote it in 1999. But I did want to write about her. She was always an inspiration to me, a sort of muse. And so I was thinking of ways that I could recreate her in a way that was just specific to me. And I thought, well, the diary format, you know, it was always rumored that Marilyn had kept a diary and it was lost or stolen or never existed. But I thought that I could take that concept and create Marilyn through her own words as filtered through my interpretation of her.
And also filtered through an exhaustive research of interviews about or people who intimately or publicly or business-wise knew Marilyn. And I think that's the most distinctive thing about the book, is that how carefully researched it is, particularly when you go back to all kinds of archives to listen to these firsthand interviews. Can you tell us about the process, how you planned it out, how long it took, and how arduous was it?
Well, for the Marilyn Monroe, The Private Life of a Public Icon, from the idea of writing a biography to completion, it was about 3 years. I started studying Marilyn when I was 11. I saw a photo of her in a magazine, and I just became very compelled by her image and by the conflicting stories about her. So I had been searching for her for many, many years. But when I set out to really find out the truth, it was about a 3-year journey of being sort of a detective. You know, Marilyn would have been in her 90s if she were alive, and the people, her contemporaries, were that age. So finding people that were still around to talk, and also the children of people that had known Marilyn, because often stories were passed down about her. And then, like you said, going into the archives and listening to audio tapes from the 70s and 80s and 90s of people that are no longer with us, and going through it, like sifting through gold, listening for the nuggets that other writers might have passed by that really had relevance and was a missing piece to the puzzle of her.
Well, there are a couple of things that are really distinctive about the book. One is how you detail how Marilyn actually was quite adroit at managing the kind of persona she developed early on in her career. And the second part is in incredible detail how this life self-destructed. So let's talk about the first part. Common, if you will, we have this notion that, you know, Marilyn was just discovered and she hit upon all these good roles in films, but she was really quite deliberate in what kind of role she took and how she managed her persona in ways that I wasn't aware of before I read your book.
She was very, you know, she wasn't school smart. She never graduated high school, but she was very canny and intuitive about things. And I think she realized that social understandings of morals and things like that were changing. She plugged into that. And So she developed this very carefree, sort of accepting attitude of sex, which was in the early 50s and mid-century, was not really accepted. But to temper that she was being very sexual and sensual, she also brought in this little girl vulnerable. It really was a part of her, but she was just very adroit at exploiting it. The orphan girl, the mistreated girl, the sexually abused girl, all taboo subjects in that day. I mean, sex symbols, there were sex symbols before Marilyn, but they were sort of manufactured by the studio in the way that they were tempered. They had personalities, but they were reined in, where Marilyn just fell out all over the place. She was very honest. She used her excruciating childhood as part of her mystique and part of her allure, and it all just came together in this moment in time. She was like the perfect combination of character traits and physicality, and it all just came together.
What was the role where the studio finally said, this isn't just another pretty face or another dumb blonde or a nice pair of you-know-what. This is somebody who can really make a role and make us money in making that role in the movie?
I would say that it was Niagara.
Uh-huh.
It was like her first big Technicolor. And it produced the image that we recognize today of Marilyn, the tousled blonde hair, the glossy red lips, the beauty mark, the creamy skin. I think that when she was doing that, it was a film noir, but it was in color, and she just dominated, the whole film. She was bigger than life, and I think they said, you know what, we've got to take this seriously. This isn't just a passing thing. This isn't just a dumb blonde. And that led her to getting Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, which was her career-defining moment.
Right. In case you're just joining us, the program is Off Script. I'm your host, Dan Dwyer. My guest today is Charles Casalo. He's written a book called Marilyn Monroe, The Private Life of a Public Icon. You mentioned that Marilyn was very carefree about sex, and the book details the numerous ongoing overlapping affairs and sexual relationships that she had, including one with a really unattractive agent, small guy that sounded kind of almost very, very unappealing, that she bedded down with early on in her career. I want to ask the next question, not to suggest that she's a sexual addict, because she, let's just say, had a very active libido. My question is, when you detail all the loves of her life and her affairs, Joe DiMaggio, Arthur Miller, et cetera, do you think it's safe or fair to categorize her as a love obsessive or a love compulsive?
I would say that the basis of all those men that you described, is starting with the agent who was sort of physically unappealing, is that it was a search for her father.
Uh-huh.
It really had less to do with even sexuality than it did to looking for a savior type.
Right.
Someone who would take her away from her insecurities. And, she grew up, she was illegitimate. She grew up in foster care and orphanages. And her mother, who was mentally unstable, would show her a photo of who her father was. They had never been married. And he came to represent to Marilyn security and someone who would protect her. And so she was always looking for him. When she actually tried to contact him when she was an adult, he wouldn't have anything to do with her. He said, contact my lawyers. And it hurt her terribly. And I think that these men, more than having anything to do with libido or sexuality, were a search for security for her.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the men in her life. And I really want to talk, I think the most explosive part of the book is her relationship with the Kennedys. Now, it has been rumored or speculated or in print, but on the fringe for a long time, that she had affairs with both President John Kennedy and his brother Robert Kennedy. You've done a lot of research. You've talked to a lot of people. And you pretty much conclude that that's not fringe speculation, that this actually happened and was actually fact.
There was relationships with both brothers. I think that where a lot of the miscommunication about it comes is that each one of them had different perceptions of what the relationship was.
Let's start with the president. What was his view of his relationship with Marilyn?
Well, he was a lady killer. He was a playboy. We know now about his exploits in the White House and with many famous actresses, as well as interns at the White House.
Some could argue he was a sex compulsive.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And Marilyn at the time was the queen of sex appeal and sex. So for him, she became the symbol of the grand prize. If he had Marilyn Monroe, he had the best.
How did they meet? You detail it in your book. How did they first meet?
Well, when she divorced Arthur Miller, he started trying to contact her through her press agent and through the Lawfords. She was friends with Peter Lawford.
You mean the president initiated the contact?
Yes. At the time, I mean, you know, Marilyn was the most sought-after woman in the world. I mean, everyone was after her, Frank Sinatra. And so the president was after her, and she finally did meet him at the the Peter Lawford, Pat Kennedy Lawford Beach House, where it was, you know, the beginning of the 60s, the swinging 60s. There was, you know, just a new sort of attitude about, I'm not going to say swinging and orgies, but, you know, that was sort of coming in, and drugs. That was all, you know, it was the
beginning
of the
60s. Lots of booze.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. And, you know, I think they were both drawn to each other as being the top of their field. I mean, he was the leader of the free world. He was the most powerful man in the world. She, in her own way, was one of the most powerful women in America as far as fame and desirability. For her, though, when a sex symbol in that time frame turned 34, 35, there was speculation that she was coming to an end. And for Marilyn, she never had any self-respect or... you know, she never was confident in herself. So she always looked for her self-worth through the eyes of the men she could attract. You know, the biggest, most famous men of the day. She sought them out as a way of validating herself. So when she was at a vulnerable age and a vulnerable stage in her life and career, she sought out the most powerful man. And that's why it became so consuming for her and so much more important to her.
Right.
And so, you know, he liked her. She was very charming. She was very beautiful. But when the word started getting out that they were seeing each other, and it wasn't this big affair that people say, but they saw each other several times.
Right.
But she put much more into it. So now, he had to distance himself, and that's when Bobby stepped in. But Bobby was more susceptible. He was more, let's say, a more sensitive man. And he really fell for Marilyn. And Marilyn said, okay, well, Bobby is, you know, he's the attorney general. He's revered. He's sensitive. He's handsome. So she started putting her hopes into him. She was very, at this stage in her life, she was always fragile. She was always emotionally weak. But at this stage, more so than ever.
This is all just about 2 or 3, 4 years before her death, right?
Well, 2 years.
Okay.
It started 2 years, like in 1960, 61.
Remind us, for people who aren't steeped in this kind of movie biography, what was the date of Marilyn's death?
She actually died on August 4th, 1962. The official date is August 5th because she died in the middle of the night. It's like, you know, did she die before midnight or after?
Right. And for those born after 1970, rather, Kennedy was elected president in 1959 and took office in 1960. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So we've got two brothers. Kind of curious that they would both be not sharing a woman at the same time, but that they would find their way to this most famous woman and celebrity and sex goddess in the world at the time. I want to get back to the Lawfords because you don't use this expression, but I'm going to use it. Peter Lawford was pimping out Marilyn for his brothers-in-law.
Yeah, he was. I mean, Marilyn, I mean, he was probably pimping out other women as well. I would say more acting as a...
A go-between.
A liaison?
Yeah, a liaison, a go-between.
You know, like Angie Dickinson, for example, was another woman. I mean, I don't want to say anything bad about Angie Dickinson. I adore the woman, but, you know, she was involved with Kennedy, too.
Of course.
No, I'm not breaking ground by saying that. And, you know, Marilyn was, everyone adored President Kennedy. He was a young, charismatic.
Charming.
Yeah, so they wanted to please him. So introducing Marilyn was like giving him a gift. It was like presenting Helen of Troy on a horse.
Okay, you don't get into this.
Here, look what we're giving you.
Right. You don't get into this in your book. And so you can see Peter Lawford as part of the Rat Pack with Frank Sinatra and, you know, wanting to curry favor and also, you know, obviously being a big name in Hollywood because his brother-in-law is now president of the United States. I can set that scene. But how do you explain Pat Kennedy Lawford, being the spouse of Peter Lawford, who had to know what was going on.
Yeah, she did know, and she was very close with Marilyn. That's a lot of people don't know that.
That's really odd. Talk about that.
Well, I think that Pat also, you know, Marilyn, beyond all her sickness and her mental illnesses and depression, she had a mask that was very compelling and very charming. And I think that even Pat Kennedy Lawford fell for Marilyn, not in a romantic way,
yeah,
but in all way. I mean, it was like these were really gods and goddesses of their era. What they did, the morality for them didn't apply. It was like they were above all of that. These were iconic figures. These were, like I said, gods and goddesses. So I think people were willing to look the other way,
mm-hmm,
when it came to people like Marilyn and JFK and Bobby Kennedy.
Right, and we didn't. And for those, again, who were born after 1970, there was no internet, there was no multimedia, and the press had an unspoken code that they would not report on incredibly intimate details of celebrities' past.
I talked to a lot, yeah, of the press that were, you know, the members of the press that are still alive today, now in their 80s and 90s, and they all said it was very well known.
Yep.
What was going on. It wasn't, you know, like a secret, but they couldn't. One of them from the book, in my book, said, where would we go with a picture, even if we got a picture of them in the Lawford driveway, in the backseat of a car or something like that? Like, there's nowhere you can go with a picture like that in that day.
Right, right. In case you're just joining us, the program's Off Script. I'm your host, Dan Dwyer. We're talking about the new book, Marilyn Monroe, The Private Life of a Public Icon, that really records, after exhaustive research, a lot of speculation that had been about Marilyn's life. And we're talking to the author, of course, Charles Cossillo. Getting back to the loft of the Rat Pack, Frank Sinatra, there's an anecdote in your book that I think really bears a lot more discussion and really, really digs deep into how intricate the overlapping social and business and political and sexual lives of all of these characters were. You've got a weekend where Marilyn goes out to Sinatra's estate in Palm Springs. Pat and Peter Lawford are also guests at the time. Marilyn's a guest, and Sam Giancana is a guest. Now, what your book doesn't acknowledge, and this isn't a criticism, but it's a fascinating wrinkle of history, is that unbeknownst to the Lawfords at the time, but very well known to Sam Giancana at the time, was that the President of the United States was through the CIA, hatching plans to assassinate Castro through mafia cutouts. And what your book doesn't acknowledge is that at the same time, which we learn from the Senate Intelligence investigation in the 1970s, is that Sam Giancana and John Kennedy shared a lover in a woman called Judith Exner.
Yeah.
This is extraordinary, the kind of reactions that must have been going on sub rosa at that Sinatra estate at that weekend while Marilyn was being drugged out. And then what does Sam Giancana do? This is the most explosive item in your book that I'd like you to tell us about.
Well, you know, I didn't go into great detail about, you know, what you're talking about with Judith Exner and all that, because I was focusing on Marilyn. There's whole books written about,
exactly,
you know, Giancana. And this was at the Cal Neighbor Lodge, which was sort of an entertainment. It was on the border of Nevada and California, so that one side of the estate you could gamble, and they had a show where, you know, people performed, and then the other side was like bungalows, which was where Marilyn was staying. And I kind of stayed away from speculation, a lot of speculation, because I was really trying to stick to the facts. I went into the book with no agenda. But I did speak to a photographer. He's passed, but I talked to his wife, and she had seen. There was photos of Marilyn was very adamant this weekend. It was the weekend before she passed away. And she was very into the drugs and the booze to numb her pain. She was in a lot of pain, a lot of emotional pain. And at one point in one of the bungalows, she was so out of it that she was on her hands and knees, and Sam Giancana was riding her like a pony, like a little kid giving a pony ride. And the photos were so degrading to her that Frank Sinatra ordered that they be destroyed. But this woman, Lily Woodfield, who was the photographer's wife, told me that she had seen them, and they showed Marilyn completely out of it, completely a mess. And it's very sad. It's very sad that a woman who came to represent glamour and Hollywood, royalty would become that. But it shows, how emotionally fragile she was. She was slowly going mad that summer.
But from Sam, let me interject just a minute. From Sam Giancana's point of view, it was a very, very sleazy underworld mafia way to send a subterranean message to the President of the United States. Don't screw around with me.
It could have been that. Like I said, I didn't go too deep into that because Sam Giancana is worthy of his own book.
Yep.
And I was staying, I was looking at things more through Marilyn's perspective and what was going on with her.
Right. Well, it's a fact that the personalities, the circumstances, and the historical covert backdrop to that weekend at Sinatra's estate in Palm Springs and it just happening a week before the death of Marilyn is just an extraordinary picture, an extraordinary tableau.
And also the last photos of her ever taken were taken that weekend, and it shows her looking very sad and gaunt and, covered, kerchief over her hair, dark sunglasses.
Yeah. As we wind down the interview, we've got about 5 or 6 minutes left. Let's talk, the thing that really does impress me, too, about the book, besides the exhaustive research you've done, besides the inside look at what really motivated Marilyn to really select how she was going to position herself, at least in her early career in the movie system, is how you really build a rhythm and chronicle with this inevitable kind of pattern, the month by month, the week by week, and then the day to day, and then in the end, the hour to hour death of Marilyn. I mean, it's really what you achieve in the last 3-4 chapters of the book is amazing. So you talked about the weekend where she was really drugged out and down and out at Sinatra's estate. What happened the week after that?
Well, it's almost Shakespearean what was going on. I mean, she was, the beautiful fading queen who was looking to the king and his brother to save her. She was involved with Bobby Kennedy, but he was also distancing himself in her final week, and she was desperate to get in touch with him. She was trying to locate him, and he was traveling with his family, and he was in San Francisco. And she came to believe that Bobby, at the same time that he was seeing her, was seeing her press secretary, whose name was Pat Newcomb. Marilyn, this was like the final blow to her ego. She was the sex goddess, the sex queen, and, Bobby was, in her eyes, going to save her from her faltering career and whatever lay in store for her. And the thought that he would, at the same time, that he was cheating on his wife with Marilyn, would be cheating on his wife with someone who was just, in Marilyn's eyes, just her press secretary, was just one blow too many. She was very, very, very angry.
And I also should add, you suggest that Marilyn was very kind of phobic about Newcomb's perhaps lesbian attraction to her.
Yes, Marilyn was, you wouldn't call Marilyn homophobic, but
no.
She was fearful of being perceived as anything homosexual in her because, as I said earlier, all her value came from men being turned on by her.
Right, right.
So she had a downright phobia. Her psychiatrist, in his papers, I saw notes that she had a phobia of herself being perceived as being a lesbian. And it has been said that her secretary had lesbian dalliances and might have been attracted to Marilyn in that way.
But Newcomb
so
is staying
at. All these complications were coming together.
Right, and Newcomb is actually staying at the house that week.
Yes.
Yeah.
They were arguing the whole weekend because Marilyn had found out that. Well, Marilyn came to believe that she was that this Pat Newcomb was involved with Bobby Kennedy at the same time, and Pat was very devoted to her, and she was also she cared about her, so she was trying to appease her, calm her down, but it kept flaring up that whole weekend. So Marilyn died that Saturday evening, feeling betrayed by all the people that were supposedly protecting her and close to her. Her press secretary, her doctor let her down. Both of her doctors let her down. Bobby Kennedy let her down. The president let her down. And that's that famous last phone call when she was on the phone with Peter Lawford and she said, say goodbye to say goodbye to the president and say goodbye to Bobby and say goodbye to yourself because you're a nice guy. And those are like the last words that we know that she ever spoke.
And what did Peter Lawford
do? They all betrayed her.
And what did Peter Lawford do? He didn't get in his car and drive up.
There was a series of phone calls. He started calling people, come over with me. Maryland's in trouble. And they were saying, you can't go over there. You're the brother-in-law of the president of the United States. There'll be a scandal. And he was getting drunker. The night was wearing on. He was calling people, and they were calling people, and no one wanted to go over there. There was a lot of miscommunications and missteps. It was a, you know, late Saturday night. And Marilyn, by then, people were getting fed up with her. She was always in a crisis. She was always, her lawyer said she could have a crisis over what to have for lunch. So it was like just, she's having another crisis kind of thing. But that night, it really was at a crucial point for her.
What happened in the investigation?
I think they rightfully found out that it was either an accidental suicide or I think that my personal opinion is that Marilyn intended to kill herself, and then she changed her mind. And she went under before she had done that before. She had
right.
called for help and was saved at the last moment. And the investigation, what causes all the murder theories that we have today, and a lot of people believe in the murder theories, because it gets very murky because there was a cover-up.
Right.
Her phone records were confiscated. Photos of her and the president were destroyed. But it wasn't because of a murder plot. There was no need to murder Marilyn Monroe. It was because of they didn't want it to come out that she was of her, their relationship with her.
One of the other famous nuggets in your book, apropos of the relationship between President Kennedy and Marilyn Monroe, is that you assert that Jackie Kennedy knew of it. And Jackie went to the president and said, this isn't another bimbo. This is real trouble. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this one's different. Her fame. See, the Kennedy wives had like sort of an unspoken, starting with Rose, you know, an unspoken rule that as long as they come home sort of attitude.
Yep.
You know, they're going to philander, but as long as they come home to the family and keep their relationships out of the papers, kind of. And so she kind of looked the other way in most of his affairs. But it was two reasons with Marilyn. Marilyn's fame. People were going to start snooping around the gossip columnists, you know, the head of hoppers of the day. We're going to it could cause a scandal for her, and that she didn't want. And the other thing is she had a real empathy, like many people. She had a real empathy for Marilyn. I mean, Marilyn had that quality about her that you couldn't help. People wanted to protect her.
Mm-hmm.
It was that little girl that lived inside of her that people responded to. And Jackie responded to that, too. He said, leave her alone. She said, leave Marilyn alone.
Right. Final question. You did enough research to see the fallout both after Marilyn's death and the Kennedy's death. Did Jackie Kennedy, this is off the record of your book, did Jackie Kennedy have any correspondence or direct relationship with Peter Lawford or Pat Kennedy after the death?
I believe that she did have, just family type things.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, they were her nephews and nieces that, you know, right. But I don't think that she had any, real kind of socializing or in-depth talks about it. But you know what? The one curious thing about Marilyn is there's always a letter popping up. Every few years, like a letter pops up or a photo pops up. That's why we continue to be fascinated with her. She lived in so many compartments.
And that's why, Charles, I was fascinated by your book, and I've got to conclude it there. Congratulations. It's really a remarkable piece of research and puts into print a lot of stuff that's been around the edges for a long time. Thanks for joining us on Off Script.
It was a pleasure.
Okay, Charles. The program, again, Off Script. I'm your host, Dan Dwyer. The guest was Charles Casselow. He's written the book, Marilyn Monroe, The Private Life of a Public Icon, in bookstores, on Amazon, on the web now. Check it out. Until you join us the next time, as a dear departed friend of mine used to say, be well.
Underwriting support for Off Script with Dan Dwyer from Johnny Cake Books in Salisbury, Connecticut, whose collection of rare, collectible, and out-of-print books is housed in a 19th-century cottage in one of the most old-fashioned small towns in New England. Off Script with Dan Dwyer is also available via podcast on our on-demand page, robinhoodradio.com. Click on On Demand and then click on Off Script with Dan Dwyer.